to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Larry Jacobs. I'm a professor here at the University of Minnesota and the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Thanks so much for joining us. We're excited about our program today, Election Insights Reporting on the 2024 election. Before we begin, I want to encourage you to participate. We rely on your questions, and you're going to see that in a little bit. And you'll see at the bottom of your screen, if you're joining us online, and I know there are a number of you who are, a Q&A button. That's how you get engaged. Click that, give us your questions. Challenging questions are welcome. Those of you who are here with us in person, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be passing around cards for you to do it the old-fashioned way, writing them down. Also, if you're online and you'd like to take advantage of closed captioning, you can see that as well at the bottom of your screen. Okay, let's jump into our program. We're so delighted to have James Homan with us. And James, first, welcome home.
Great to be home. It's so nice to find MSP, and I miss Minnesota every day.
Just a quick bio question. You grew up here. You went to high school.
Grew up in Apple Valley, went to Eastview High School. Okay. A lot of Apple Valley folks here.
Yeah, this is a heavy hometown turnout. Well, for those of you who know James, will know that he is one of the rising stars in reporting the national scene at the Washington Post and Washington area. He made a real name for himself as the editor and driver of what was known as the Daily 202. 202 is the area code for Washington, D.C., and it was kind of pro forma. You'd wake up in the morning and you'd go to the 202 to see what were the stories, what was happening that day, and that was for a whole lot of people. He's now an editorial writer and a columnist at the Washington Post. He's the chief commentator for the Washington Post video team, and we're going to want to talk about that as well. Before that, he worked at Politico, which is another one of those inside the Beltway, the 202 area, political reporting sites. A lot of us rely on it to get kind of a sense of what's happening all over Washington, including in Congress and the White House. Before all that, he was at Stanford University, where he is a lecturer. So thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and we know you're a busy guy.
What a great election to talk about. So much going on.
There is. And so you're going to help us. And one of the things that's wonderful about having James with us is he's both a commentator and a reporter on the election, but he's also one of the key people in deciding what is newsworthy, given his spot as an editor. So we're going to ask him some different questions that maybe we wouldn't get to. Obviously, conversation has really been focused on Donald Trump's conviction last week, it's 24/7 about it. Were you surprised by the near unanimity among Republicans about the outcome and how it was fixed and a phony process?
I would have been surprised a few years ago, for sure. What was most striking is Larry Hogan is running for Senate in Maryland. It is a huge recruit for Mitch McConnell and Steve Daines, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Larry Hogan, a popular former governor, he's actually leading in the polls right now. This is a state that is as blue as West Virginia is red. And Larry Hogan is very competitive. And he put out a totally rational statement saying you have to respect the verdict and the jury has spoken, and you immediately had Chris LaCivita, one of Trump's senior advisors, say your campaign is over. And then Laura Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, going on CNN and saying the national Republicans aren't going to spend money to help Larry Hogan. And I was struck by the very few number of people who said kind of respect the rule of law, and they immediately were attacked. And I do think that that is a reflection of the degree to which Donald Trump has consolidated control over the party. A few years ago, you talked to a lot of Republicans privately who would say, like, I have to be for Trump, but this guy's a crazy person. And a lot of those people are leaving. They've either retired or they're on their way out. And now it is Trump's party. And I think that the response to the verdict and the pilgrimage that people like the Speaker of the House, but also everyone who wants to be Trump's running mate, all went to this criminal trial in Manhattan. I think 10 years ago in the before times, that would have seemed shocking. It's still surprising, but it is the era that we live in, and it is very much a cult of personality that is animating this political movement.
We often talk about incentive structures where, you know, politicians will look at an election or, you know, political maneuvering, and then they'll be making assessments about how they will behave in the future. When you look at how this trial played out, and particularly the near unanimity among Republicans, Republican office holders, many Republican voters, not 100%, but many, and then the donor world, do you look at this and say, oh, the incentives now in the Republican Party is to be really tilting against the democratic system, the legal order?
I think we will look at this as a turning point in our politics. I do think Donald Trump is this. It's crazy because we're talking about Donald Trump appropriately. And in a lot of ways, this election is a referendum on Donald Trump, even though he's not the incumbent president. So it's sort of I think it's appropriate because this is an election about Donald Trump and Trump's agenda. But it also is unusual to be focused on the challenger. I think that we're going to be in this era. You saw Donald Trump yesterday on Newsmax say that he wants to lock up his political opponents. He's previously said that he wants the Justice Department to prosecute not just Democrats, but former allies, people who worked in his administration and sort of turned against him, people like John Bolton and Bill Barr. And I think we're in this era where it's an escalation ladder. And whatever your feelings about this prosecution in New York, I do think we're going to move into a new period where politicians are going to sort of assume that they're going to get indicted for something after they leave office. And they may not be found guilty because we do have a jury system. We do have the rule of law. We have appeals. But Trump clearly has convinced a majority of his party that he is a martyr and that he is being targeted because, as he says in his stump speech, he's the only thing standing between me and you, or between them and you. So I think we will see this as a hinge point in our politics.
Yeah, and just to fill out your point about former elected officials who might expect to get indicted, Joe Biden. Are you thinking Joe Biden would be fair game if he lost?
I don't think he'd be fair game, but I think he will be. I would be shocked if they if Trump wins, if there weren't investigations and criminal inquiries, and that's at the federal level. At the state level, you know, you saw Wisconsin move yesterday against Ken Cheeseborough, and Arizona and Georgia have acted. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see, just as a hypothetical, the Attorney General of Texas trying to charge Joe Biden with like dereliction of duty over failing to secure the southern border. I think that would get laughed out of court. But I do think we're in this new era. This term has become cliche of lawfare, where politics is going to essentially be fought in the courts, as opposed to, in addition to all the other traditional sort of fronts that we're aware of. And I do think that ultimately is corrosive and bad for the system, and it will cast doubt on the legitimacy of the courts. And I think it's hugely problematic. And that's why I do think Trump is playing with fire when he attacks the courts, when he attacks Justice Juan Merchan for being from Colombia and says, of course, he was going to rule against me because of where he's from. We saw that in 2016 when he attacked Judge Curiel over the Trump University case. But these things, when you talk about incentives, it takes a toll. People listen, young people, for the longest time, in the kind of the late aughts, early 2010s, every Democrat tried to talk like Barack Obama. And Pete Buttigieg, if you watch him, he sounds like he's doing like an Obama impression. It's the way that in the 60s and 70s, a lot of Democrats tried to talk like JFK and be Kennedy-esque. And you have a whole new crop of ambitious young people who want to go into politics, want to be in public service, and see Donald Trump as the model. And I think only Trump can be Trump. I don't think anyone can out-Trump Trump. We saw that in the Republican primaries where DeSantis tried to be Trumpier than Trump. But it will change the way that people behave. And ultimately, we do have one party that is sort of focused on playing by the rules and another party that is trying to challenge the rules altogether and challenge the whole system.
A few weeks ago, Rob Portman,
yeah,
former Republican senator from Ohio, was visiting, and his response to the trial was, this is not a strong case, should never have been brought. But also the consequences, and he was predicting just what you were describing and saying, Democrats are going to come to regret this moment. Was this on the Democratic Party? Was this like a miscalculation by Democrats and by the district attorney in Manhattan to bring this case?
It's really unfortunate that the only case that's going to be brought against Trump before the election is what our newspaper called the runt of the litter. And it really is. It is the weakest case. He clearly committed the crime. He clearly paid this hush money and classified it as a business expense and legal fees. I think that you couldn't, I think on appeal, he actually has a pretty strong case that the way the kind of the Russian nesting doll, the way that the charges were structured is sort of unusual. And maybe Stormy Daniels was allowed to say too much during her testimony to make that would be prejudicial to the jury. I could see an appellate court striking down some of the conviction. I think, you know, Alvin, I think one of the things that we need to be careful not to fall into the trap of is it's not like the Biden White House had nothing to do with this. Alvin Bragg was an elected prosecutor. He did run on getting Donald Trump, which was, I think, in, you know, poor form, bad judgment. You shouldn't, when you're running to be an elected prosecutor, talk about going after people. But it's unfortunate because the two federal cases and the Georgia case are so much stronger. The classified documents case is a slam dunk. The evidence is overwhelming. It's clear. It gets to the it gets to the core question of your fitness for the presidency, and we're not going to see those. You know, if Trump wins in November, we'll never see those federal cases brought. So I don't know that. I think Alvin Bragg was acting in his self-interest, but you're right. It definitely backfired. I've talked to some of the Republican presidential candidates who say that Trump essentially won the nomination in 2024, the day that Bragg brought the case. And Ron DeSantis's internal polling showed that that was the day the nomination essentially ended. And so you have to take Alvin Bragg's claims at face value that he would have brought the charges no matter what, and he would have followed the facts and the law, blah, blah, blah. But it clearly politically didn't play out the way that a lot of Democrats thought it would.
But in terms of legal process,
yeah,
we do have, you know, country of laws.
Yeah, no. And that's part of the, I'm not actually rendering judgment. I think Trump committed the crime, and I think the jury, which had two lawyers on it, someone who gets their news from Truth Social, after just a day and a half came to consensus that he had broken the law. And I think there's mitigating factors in sentencing, which is, you know, he's a 77-year-old guy who's been convicted of a nonviolent crime, who has no prior criminal record. In a normal situation, you'd probably give someone like this a few hundred hours of community service or something, or a big fine. But Trump has attacked the justice system. He's attacked the judge. He's attacked the witnesses. He has shown no remorse. So all of that also weighs toward kind of, how do you not take it seriously? How do you not give him a sentence that fits his conduct?
We were talking before about the coverage, yeah, and some of your reaction to the coverage itself. One of the things that was quite striking and seemed to be timed, though not entirely, to the guilty verdict in New York, is the movement of wealthy donors, Wall Street donors, to support Donald Trump. A number of them have been on the sidelines, were quite critical. The case that stuck out for me was Ken Griffin, who is the guy who built Citadel. And he at one point called Trump a three-time loser. And now he's ponying up to the Trump campaign. And I guess one of the questions that I would ask as someone who writes about finance is, where's the bottom line orientation here? I mean, we kind of have a sense based on the first term that Donald Trump will cut taxes. He'll do what he can to cut regulation, but he creates a lot of instability in the international financial system, international trade. What's going on with kind of rich America?
We ran an editorial recently that said CEOs should think bigger about their cost benefit analysis. They clearly are doing a cost benefit analysis. Trump literally, in a pretty brazen way, was at a fundraiser with oil and gas CEOs and said, "Raise me $1 billion, and you're going to get a huge return on investment because I'm going to save you billions of dollars with deregulation and tax cuts." And I mean, he's not wrong, but I think, especially the Wall Street types who should care about the, you know, default and those kinds of things, I think people have sort of rationalized and justified and twisted themselves into pretzels. I think there's like some kind of nostalgia. There's people have deluded themselves into forgetting what things were like even before COVID. But certainly a lot of the donors are giving money because they think it will ultimately be profitable. And, you know, good for them, bad for the country. I think there are people who have that view and are nevertheless owning up. And I also think the train's leaving the station. You know, if you want an ambassadorship, the polls, I mean, there's a widespread belief among Republicans that Trump would win the election. There's an expectation he'll win. And so that is part of it too, is trying to buy access.
So it's kind of politics as usual. Even though this is,
I mean, the irony, of course, is that Donald Trump, when he ran in 2015 and 2016, I was at those rallies where he said, "I'm never going to take a dime from anyone. I'm going to self-fund because money is so corrupting. And I know because I bought off a lot of politicians, and when you give them money, they'll do what you tell them." And like, I mean, there's so many clips of Trump saying stuff like that not that long ago, and now he's out there basically shaking down donors for money.
Oh, that's so inspiring. Let's talk about Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one view of Hunter Biden as, you know, a troubled individual who's really struggled with addiction and terrible choices. And but he's the son of the president of the United States. Is there a legitimate kind of balancing that goes on in the newsroom from sitting at your desk where you say, we gave all this coverage to Donald Trump's trial? Now we have to balance it with coverage of Hunter Biden, even though not a comparable case.
Yeah, I think it's less we have to because then the sitting president of the United States' son is on trial. The first lady is sitting in court. The president's daughter is sitting in court crying, as you know, yesterday. The prosecution, Joe Biden's Justice Department, although it's a special counsel, played audio tapes of Hunter reading aloud from his memoir where he talks about his drug addiction. And I mean, I think, put Trump aside, I honestly believe that there would be more coverage if in a kind of normal time, because it is a huge story. I think there's a lot of trial fatigue. I think everyone was camped out in Manhattan for weeks and weeks, and it's sort of one trial right after the other. It's also a little awkward because there are two different Hunter trials. There's the one right now in Delaware, which is actually pretty clear cut. He signed a form saying he wasn't using drugs, and by his own admission, he was using drugs. The harder one, and I mean, that's not normally prosecuted. You can say it's selective prosecution, you know, you can, but the tax case is actually trickier and in some ways more damning for the administration because it draws more attention to Hunter trading on his name and getting on boards like a Ukrainian natural gas company when he had no background in energy. So the Anyway, I think we would have covered Hunter Biden's trial very aggressively, regardless of Trump. But it is, it's also, it's harder because the federal court is different than the New York court. So you can't, like, we had reporters in the courtroom in New York last week who could type on their laptops and be sending messages. And in this, in the federal courthouse, you have to, like, literally go across the street to the DoubleTree in Wilmington, Delaware, to be able to file a dispatch. And so there's not the same kind of live blog. And anyway, it's a sad story. I mean, it's the, not to go into the details of it, but you know, this week we could hear testimony from his ex-wife, his dead brother's, you know, widow who he had an affair with, the a stripper who he got pregnant while, you know, he was involved with these other women. I mean, it's incredibly salacious, and it's the son of the president. So I think at any time that would be a huge story.
Yeah, there was Jimmy Carter's brother.
Yeah, I
know, right? It was a favorite topic
yeah.
for years.
And Bill Clinton's, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay.
I mean, this is, but it's, I mean, not, I'm not, because it is sad. He is an addict. Yeah. He has, but I don't think we're just covering Hunter because of Trump.
One of the things that's always hard in reporting and commenting on elections is making judgments about the future. And here we are in June, and there's a lot of commentary about this is really going to have an impact on the election, but a lot of that's not true. You know, we're 4 or 5 months from Election Day, and maybe you could give us a sense of what you think might stick. Do you think this conviction is something voters are really going to be thinking about come the fall?
I really don't. I think, you know, if you're with Trump or you're against Trump, people's views are pretty gelled. My analysis is that we had a period of really high turnout elections, including 2022 when Trump wasn't on the ballot because of Dobbs. I think turnout will be way lower in 2024 than it was in 2020, partly because it's going to be a lot harder to vote in a lot of places during the COVID changes, partly because most Americans are unhappy with this choice and aren't excited about either. I do think there will be a lot of people who vote for Biden because they don't like Trump. But I think that there is a big question about how much will turnout fall, and it's going to ultimately be really close. I think it's going to, if Biden can figure out a way to win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, he wins. I think the Sun Belt is sort of moving Trump's way. That is Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and I think the upper Midwest, industrial Midwest, Rust Belt, whatever you want to call it, is moving more in Biden's direction. So it sets up an election that will again be decided by a couple hundred thousand votes.
And do you think the conviction though might weigh on the couple hundred thousand?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately the people who are going to decide, you don't want to oversimplify it. I mean, I think if the election was today, Trump would win. A week after being convicted of 34 different counts of felony charges, I have no doubt that if you just had the election today, Trump would win. But the election's not today. It's 5 months from now. We're going to have the first debate on CNN on June 27th. I think that is going to be sort of a reset moment. We're going to have the conventions. I mean, I think a lot of people have pretty locked in views of Trump and Biden, and there's not a lot of movement. So to oversimplify things, I think that basically there's 100,000 people in five states that are going to decide this election. And, you know, I talk to people in both parties who go to these focus groups, you know, every night. I just talked to someone who was at a focus group in Arizona with white college educated women in the Phoenix suburbs who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. And this person told me that the conviction didn't move any of them, you know, that the group was kind of split. But those are the voters who are going to decide who wins. And ultimately, you know, I think if they're thinking about Trump's legal problems and the chaos that follows Trump loses, if they're thinking about other stuff, if, you know, in Arizona, if they're thinking about the border, then Biden probably loses, and we just don't know what they'll be thinking about 6 months from now.
Okay, so that answers kind of a big question, which is this kind of hyperventilating about the importance of this conviction is probably overheated. It's important.
The media has a tendency to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's got historic importance.
Yeah. Oh, it's hugely important.
It's, you know, for our country, it's important, but you know, for the outcome of the 2024 election, it's been kind of we're hyperventilating on it. You know, one of the challenges every election cycle, is the group of people who are just not following things.
Right.
And for, freaks like us, who, you know, are 24/7 on political news, it's inconceivable. But those are going to be the part of that 100,000
totally.
Who are going to be, you know, tilting the election one way or another. What do you think is going to wake up those people? There's a kind of reaction among, you know, this circle of freaks, and we're in it. We're like, oh my God, it's not the conviction of a president that's kind of waking you up. What is it? Is it just kind of you have to make a choice come November?
Honestly, I think a lot of those people will end up just not voting, and that's it's a weird thing. I think they should vote, but I just think that at the end of the day, I mean, maybe abortion animates some of those voters. I think people who aren't freaks, not all of them. A lot of people feel a civic duty. But I think there are a last time in 2020, the election was 81 million for Biden to 74 million for Trump. Obviously, 40,000 votes, you know, 20,000 votes in Wisconsin, 10,000 votes in Georgia, 10,000 votes in Arizona. You know, those move the other way. The election has a different outcome. But I don't think you're going to have the kind of top line numbers the same as before. I might be wrong. People might get engaged in a way. I don't know what people are going to learn about Donald Trump in the next 6 months that they don't already know. I don't really know how Biden turns things around. So I think we're in for a slog. I mean, this is the longest general election ever in history. And I don't know how it ends, but I think it's going to be a slog.
Yeah, it's really one of the kind of clearest findings from this post-conviction period. That, you know, Biden's situation is sticky. He's in a, you know, in a kind of loser spot in terms of, you know, looking at the horse race. Cause if a conviction of the president doesn't really move things,
right.
I mean, you can kind of squint and see a 1 or 2 point shift, but I don't think anyone thinks that's sturdy or necessarily decisive.
It reminds me of that SNL skit from the 88 campaign where John Lovitz is playing like Dukakis, and he turns at one point and says, "I can't believe I'm losing to this guy." and I think that is sort of the Biden feeling, and there's a lot of rationalizations. It's always a sign that you're losing when you hear from people being like, "Well, the polls are skewed and the polls actually favor Trump over us." And there's a division in Biden world. There are people who realize they're in trouble, and then there are people who, including the president, who sort of feel like they're in much better shape than they are. And you know, I think there is a desire on the campaign side to like shake things up. And so you saw that last week when they sent Robert De Niro to the courthouse to like have his impromptu news conference. And that was a desire to be like, we're losing. Let's try to shake things up. We need to act like the underdog. We need to have, you know, we can't act like this isn't a Rose Garden strategy. And I think that particular event backfired because it made the trial look more political, and it made the story Trump versus Biden, which works to Trump's advantage. But it is a reflection of a sense among the Biden high command that they've got to do something differently because they are in real trouble.
Yeah. This is on the theme of what's going to stick in 4 or 5 months. Last month, there was 6 weeks ago, there was quite a to-do over the Trump intervention in the immigration bipartisan agreement. People who are policy-oriented were in disbelief that this agreement, after decades of inaction, was, you know, a real possibility. And Trump said, "Don't do it. It'll hurt me politically." And then the Republicans steamrolled it. And Biden said, it's going to cost you at election time. That seems unlikely.
Well, you know, it's, I think that in our latest poll, Biden's approval rating on immigration is like 26%. It's really bad. You know, you're absolutely right. Donald Trump wants the issue. He doesn't want to solve the problem. And he has gotten immense political mileage out of the wall and border security. So what I think the Biden strategy is to neutralize the issue. No one in Biden world thinks they can win on immigration, but that if they can fight it to a draw, not even a draw, but you know, if you can get to a 40% approval rating instead of a 26% approval rating, if people who might not, especially in Arizona and Nevada, vote for you otherwise, feel like you're trying to do something to secure the border. The flip side, so he released this executive order effective at 12:01 a.m. today. Basically, they closed the border, they stopped asylum, but the administration knows that that's going to get enjoined. A court, the ACLU filed a lawsuit yesterday. It's almost certainly going to get struck down imminently before it really has an impact. They know that. That's why they wanted this congressional action. But they're trying to show these voters that I'm talking about, those 100,000 people who are going to decide the election, that he's taking the problem seriously. The flip side is, are there people who stay home who don't vote because they don't see a difference between the two? And it is, you know, I teach a class at Stanford, and I am always struck by how different the mentality of my students is vis-a-vis, like, the, when you talk to professional Democratic operatives who are like, it's so obvious that Biden's the lesser of two evils candidate and they're all going to vote for Biden. And then you talk to not all young people aren't a monolith, but there are a lot of young people who right now, at least, are not in this kind of, I have to choose one or the other. They may not vote at all. And, anyway, do some of the younger people get turned off by the border stuff? I don't know. I think, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about Gaza, and I think that actually could end up having a bigger impact on youth turnout than the immigration. But perhaps it matters with Hispanic voters on the margins in places like not just Arizona and Nevada, which I've mentioned a couple times, but even Georgia has a huge Latino population.
We've got a lot of questions here from folks with us and online. And, you know, a set of them are around the democracy theme. And of course, the Washington Post, your employer, has as its underneath the banner, Washington Post, it says democracy dies in darkness. And so since you've got a kind of a name brand on democracy, where are we in terms of democracy? You talked about a turning point. Do you see that as we're really on the cusp of losing important elements of our democracy, or is that a Democratic talking point aimed at mobilizing voters?
I don't think, you know, you talk to people like Liz Cheney and she'll say, if Trump wins in 2024, this will be the last election we ever have, which is a sobering thing for Liz Cheney to say. Right. And I think that the way democracy corrodes is less obvious than that. You know, you look at a lot of places like Hungary, which the, you know, Tucker Carlson et al. And J.D. Vance hold out Viktor Orban as this role model. It's more subtle. They go after it. They're not going to say no elections. You go after civil society. You prosecute your political rivals. You tip the scales. You use the justice system to change the rules of the game. You know, you look at honestly what like, in Wisconsin. So redistricting that's so extreme that, you know, that Democrats had no credible path to winning the legislature until the courts changed. So that I think is the way democracy corrodes, more than sort of like Trump comes in and says, I'm president for life and we're never going to have another election. It's not going to, that's not how it happens. You know, this is not the end of the Weimar Republic.
Would you give credence to the kind of alarming coverage about the Trump's second term agenda? There's been a lot of talk, you know, about the different plans that are being put together, not by the Trump campaign, but by these allies.
Yeah.
One of which is to severely weaken the independence of the Justice Department, to reorient the FBI towards conservative causes. Is that part of this?
Yes. All of that is part of, you know, using law enforcement. You know, I think it's so often with Trump, it's sort of like, I know what you are, but what am I? Or you know what I am, but what are you, whatever the, you know, the, and like, I do think Trump often attacks people for what he wants to do. And I do think that if Trump actually could consolidate, if Trump could put people like Jeffrey Clark in charge of the Justice Department, and I think it would be hugely problematic. I think Project 45 is very real. I think a second Trump term, I don't think a lot of these swing voters we're talking about, kind of moving from the political atmospheric realm to the substantive realm, understand how a second Trump term would be very different than a first Trump term. And in a lot of ways, more problematic, because he knows more what he's doing this time. He's not surrounding himself with people like Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster. He would be surrounding himself with people who are involved in Project 45, people like Russ Vogt and Stephen Miller.
So could you just briefly clue people in about
This guy, Russ Vogt, was
Project 45.
Russ Vogt was the head of the Office of Management and Budget under Trump. He was a key player in the first impeachment over the Ukraine funding. He is an ideologue. And, you know, so Project 45 is this effort that involves, I think, like 100 different conservative outside groups. It's sort of organized out of the Heritage Foundation. And it's basically in all these different subject areas, they're like, here are the really conservative things we could do. But it's not really kind of traditional conservatism. This is, you know, a lot of it's protectionism, nativism, isolationism. You think about something like the Comstock Act, which is this, no one talks about this enough. And, you know, you now have Trump out there saying, I'm not going to sign federal legislation on abortion, because he reads the polls and knows that it's a huge liability. But who does Trump put in charge of the FDA? And who does Trump put in charge of the, you know, in postal inspector jobs, a general counsel at USPS? And you have this sort of ticking time bomb in the federal code that several members of the Supreme Court sound very eager to uphold, namely Alito and Clarence Thomas, where they essentially could block the mailing of mifepristone and other things. So you could see the Supreme Court upholding abortion access in key ways, but then Trump coming in and through the agency rulemaking process, sort of the administrative state, having a really pulling the levers. That's the kind of stuff Project 45 is working on. And they have these very ambitious plans for the Comstock Act. I don't want to sound like some conspiracy minded person, but that is what they're planning to do. That is what they're looking at.
That's what they're talking about. Yeah. So you've been following Washington politics inside the Beltway for a long time. You're a Politico. And one of the golden rules of inside the Beltway is nothing happens fast.
Right.
And it rarely happens the way it's been designed. That James Madison put a curse on American decision-making.
Or a blessing, depending on whether you're in charge.
That's right. It could be, there are a whole lot of liberals who could be thinking of James Madison as a really favorable force, because we've got these built-in checks. You know, if you're going to have someone at the Justice Department who is going to be a right-winger, they do have to get, approved by the Senate. After nominated, you have got congressional oversight, control over appropriations. Does all that go away?
We have a lot of checks and balances, and that's part of it. Trump doesn't become president and say, I'm dissolving Congress, of course. But Republicans are going to control the Senate. I would put the odds at no more than 10% that Democrats hold the Senate. They just have to run the table. They already will lose West Virginia. And so, you know, Mitt Romney's going to be gone. It's not going to be the same Republican Senate. Mitch McConnell will no longer be leader. I think a lot of people who hate Mitch McConnell will miss the days of Mitch McConnell next year. And so you're going to have a scenario where you're going to be really counting on like Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins to oppose the most extreme Trump nominees. And, you know, you saw what happened with Brett Kavanaugh, where they all got on board, got on the team. I think there's a presumption that you should give the president their nominees, especially for executive branch offices. And so these checks and balances, these guardrails that existed and held in the first term, I think that they could hold, you know, the difference between a 55 seat Republican Senate and a 51 seat or 52 seat Republican Senate is significant in terms of what kind of wild people will make it through customs. But anyway, like there will be checks, but, and there will be oversight, but we saw Trump was perfectly willing in the first term to sort of ignore Congress on a lot of stuff. Congress wouldn't appropriate money for the wall. He diverted money that had Congress had approved for military construction and sent it to the wall. So there are constraints. It's not like he can be totally free, but I think he will be savvier in a second term about bypassing some of those constraints.
Yeah, this is one of the issues that probably doesn't get enough attention, which is how there's been a bipartisan agreement to expand the president's authority and unilateral authority to act.
Yeah. And the imperial presidency is very real. The imperial
presidency is here. And, you know, there was a kind of a freak out moment during the second half of Trump's term. The question was, could he decide to bomb, use nuclear weapons against China or against other countries? And, you know, there were Senate hearings on it. We had some of the top brass at the Pentagon reviewing the chain of command on that. And that's one element, but there's a lot of authority the presidents have, and both parties have been kind of in agreement that given the deadlock in Washington and given the threats internationally, it's important for presidents to have that leeway. Well, then you get a president like Donald Trump who doesn't play by the same playbook and doesn't have the same values or norms. And it's a different ballgame.
Yeah, and again, for the nuclear example, and again, I don't want to sound like one of those zany people. It's like Trump's going to launch the nukes, and but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be alarmed. he's not going to, you know, he picked Mark Milley to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's not going to pick Mark Milley to be the chairman again. He'll pick someone who's more pliant. And
Mark Milley was one of the people who reviewed the chain of command over the nukes.
And so the, you know, in the Secretary of Defense, you know, you can names like Kash Patel, there are these people that are going to be empowered in a second Trump term if he wins, that again, I don't think Trump's going to go, you know, but he could functionally, same thing with NATO. He's not, I don't think that there's a scenario where Trump says the United States of America is withdrawing from NATO. In fact, I think the last year's National Defense Authorization Act required him to get permission from Congress. But you don't need to formally withdraw from NATO to undermine NATO. All Trump has to say is, which he said already, like if countries aren't paying their dues, I'm not going to send U.S. troops to defend them. You know, I'm not going to send U.S. troops to defend France if France isn't pulling its weight. And that sends a message to Putin. So you don't need to say I'm pulling out of NATO to have a huge effect. He won't commit to defend Taiwan. Obviously there's a reason for strategic ambiguity, but I'm not sure Trump actually is committed to defending Taiwan the way that I think Joe Biden is. And if he makes some statements, does that embolden Xi to be like, okay, now I can make my move because the U.S. isn't going to go to war to protect this tiny island. Right. And so that's where it's the posture matters as much as sort of the actual.
So let's talk about foreign policy and national security. Usually presidential elections are fought on domestic issues, and there's plenty, inflation and the economy and immigration. But we also have a kind of perilous set of circumstances on the international scene in which the U.S. is involved in cold wars or hot wars. And I guess the question is, looking forward to that 4 or 5 month perspective, could you see a situation in which September, October, either because of international events or a decision by the Biden campaign to profile these international issues, whether it's Taiwan, Ukraine in particular?
Yes. Biden, you have to be careful because you don't want to seem like you don't want to be George H.W. Bush, right? And seem like you're so focused on foreign affairs that you're not focused on people's pain at home and that you're distracted. But obviously I do think foreign policy is an advantage for Biden. I think he's in France, tomorrow's the D-Day anniversary. He's giving a big speech on Friday where he's going to point to Hook, where the Reagan gave his most, you know, one of his most famous speeches 40 years ago this week. He's going to try to summon this sort of, here is the choice in this election. And I think that that does help at the margins with especially some of those suburban voters that it will decide the election. The problem is it's not just Biden who gets to decide, right? And there are a lot of countries that have a very strong desire for Trump to be in power again, because it means chaos. It means abdication of American leadership. And so does Putin do something in October? And this doesn't even get to like election interference and stuff that might happen. Does something happen in the Middle East where, you know, there's another terrorist attack, or, you know, God forbid there's a terrorist attack from someone who illegally crossed the southern border, which would be a catastrophic politically for Biden. It's not just Biden who gets to decide. The world has it's a tinderbox that has a way of catching on fire. On Israel and Gaza, I do think that that's one of those things where it really could depress turnout in Michigan and Minnesota. And that terrifies the White House, and they are desperate to try to bring the conflict to an end and to get the hostages home and to just get it out of the headlines, because if we're all talking about Gaza the week before the election, that is bad news for Joe Biden. It rivens his base. It divides. He needs not just strong Muslim turnout. He also needs strong Jewish turnout. And so I think they're eager to just solve that. Benjamin Netanyahu has a different incentive than Joe Biden. And arguably Netanyahu has an interest in Trump coming back to power, as does Mohammed bin Salman. Would be happy if Trump came back to power. So will they do things like change the oil supply in subtle ways, not to necessarily like poke Biden in the eye publicly, but that tilt the playing field just a little bit, where if this election is going to be decided by 10,000 votes in a country of 330 million people, that it could make the difference, that maybe gas prices are a little higher, maybe the U.S. has to send troops somewhere. And I think, like, if to your point about the salience of foreign policy, if Joe Biden sent troops to Haiti, that would not be helpful politically. I think we've editorialized that there should be some U.S. peacekeepers, and that we can help. We could actually help in a way that would protect our forces. But Biden's not doing that, because the idea of, like, these never endless wars, drawing attention to the withdrawal from Afghanistan, anything that would do that, I think, would be hurtful to Biden. In a lot of ways, he never really recovered polling wise from that withdrawal. And so anyway, it's complicated. I think that they like the idea of him as a statesman, and Biden especially, but it cuts multiple different ways.
This is a really interesting time, because if you look at the last 50 years or so of presidential elections, it's very rare, even during the Vietnam War, for foreign policy or national security to kind of rise into even the top five, let alone the top three. But this might be a situation where there are incentives for Biden and the world, mm-hmm. is putting it on America and Biden's plate, where we could see that come the fall. I want to ask you about a slightly different topic. If you look at what the kind of response within the Democratic Party by American Arabs and American Somalis here in Minnesota and elsewhere, there's been a very strong reaction to the Biden administration's policies in Gaza. And we saw 19-20% of Democratic Party primary voters casting a ballot for uncommitted, as a signal to the Biden campaign that they shouldn't count on their support.
Right.
And I'm just curious, when you isolate on, this important growing group of voters within the Democratic coalition, do you think this is a moment for Muslim Americans where their political power is kind of emerging on the national stage?
Yes. If Trump wins and it's a close election, and you know, if Trump wins because Biden narrowly loses Michigan, I think this comes back to the same conversation about college students too, where the Biden team's view is like, you think Trump's going to be better, you think Trump's going to pull back Israel more, Trump wants a Muslim ban, you know, Trump all these, you know, Trump's promising to deport non-US citizens who are in these protests and on campuses. And so that's the Biden view, but the reality is like, well, you don't take us for granted. And so that's the tension, right? So I think there's a scenario where Biden loses because Arab voters don't vote for him.
Or Biden loses because he hasn't been smart enough or aggressive enough.
Right.
In the Middle East, that he was too forceful in backing Netanyahu from the start, and has put, you know, from that perspective of Muslim Americans, put too little pressure.
Totally. And the danger is that he pisses off everyone, right? The danger is that he angers a lot Jewish voters. There are way more Jewish voters than Muslim Arab American voters in the United States. They're not single issue voters. But the, you know, the danger is that Democrats typically win like 70% of Jewish voters. You somehow anger some number of Jewish voters, and there are a lot in Pennsylvania, which is probably the ball game in this campaign. And you anger Arab American voters, and like everyone's sort of unhappy. I think the most dangerous thing, especially when you're the statesman who's holding yourself out as this great peacemaker or whatever word you want to use, if you don't look like you have core convictions, if you sort of look like you're trying to be too cute by half, you're trying to thread the needle on, you know, LNG, it's not a ban, it's a study, and you're doing a lot of stuff like that where you're trying to make everyone happy. The border executive order he put out yesterday, I think, being potentially an example of that. You know, you're making a lot of decisions for political reasons. They were going to ban menthol cigarettes, and they decided not to ban menthol cigarettes because they were concerned it would depress African-American male turnout. And all of a sudden those things start to add up. And then you just look like another politician who's making political choices as opposed to like core convictions. You know, you may not always agree with me, but you know where I stand. And that is a huge danger for Biden, because that is where sort of you have a lot of voters, Arab Americans, others who are saying, you know what, you're just another politician, and I don't feel like you really care about me. You care about getting reelected. And so I'm not going to go stand in line for an hour to vote. That I think is something Biden's not really controlling for. I think that they're trying to splice and dice the electorate. And I think that's coming at the expense of sort of some more holistic vision of like, here's why you should give me 4 more years.
We've got a lot of questions here from our friends. I've been asking some of them, but, maybe we could do a lightning round.
Sure.
Okay. So we were just talking, you were just talking about African-American voters. There's been polling. I think the poll that really caught people's attention was back in December from Gallup that showed this 24% decline in support among African-Americans for Democrats. And as we look at, you know, continuing line of polls, there's real concern that voters of color are shifting away from the Democratic Party. One, do you think that's going to show up in actual voting? And why is that happening?
Biden is going to end up winning the African-American vote by 45-50%, but you know, that may not be enough. I think that I think some of it is just politics, where people feel like, I vote for this party every time, and are they delivering for me and my community? I think some of it relates to sort of the education attainment divides that are popping up in our politics. You know, the biggest beyond race, but a better predictor than gender for how you'll vote is whether you've graduated from college or not. And so a lot of Biden's slippage among African Americans is among non-college graduate African American men. He still is hitting his historic numbers among college educated African-American.
They actually look a lot like white voters.
And so that's those are the folks that sort of they do, you know, and they have the same interests and the same sensibilities in some ways. And so the similar sensibilities. And so that is those, and Biden is trying really hard to be the, you know, he did a bunch of UAW events in Michigan a few weeks ago that were aimed at Black men. He did, you know, he spoke at the NAACP. He did deliver the Morehouse commencement address and basically made a very pointed appeal to exactly these sorts of voters.
To kind of a hushed audience.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's not enthusiasm for Biden among communities of color.
Right. And if Trump can just peel off, you know, that's always been the, if you can get 20% of the African-American vote, that may be enough. And especially because the election is going to be decided in places like Philly, Detroit, Milwaukee, Atlanta. So Trump's spending so much money doing outreach, and they'll also, it's not just going to be positives. They're going to do negatives too. They're going to try to suppress turnout by like convincing people that Biden doesn't care about them, et cetera.
We've got several questions here basically saying, why haven't we talked about Kennedy?
A lot of RFK fans.
So let's talk about Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
It's interesting, after the conviction, there was such a tsunami around the conviction and then attention to the Biden-Trump campaign. There seems to be a little bit of a slippage in support for Kennedy, not a you know, kind of a collapse, but a little bit of a slippage. And I'm just curious if you see Kennedy kind of losing some traction, which is not unusual among third party candidates, or if you see him as really being, you know, a decider, not a winner, but a decider, a kind of a kingmaker as we move into the fall.
I'd be shocked if RFK Jr. ends up getting double digits in November. That doesn't mean he can't be decisive and a kingmaker and pivotal. You know, if in 2016, Hillary Clinton would have handily won if you took out, you know, Jill Stein, in not to mention Gary Johnson, and some of those voters would have voted for Trump. But so he can definitely play the role of spoiler. It's interesting because for the longest time, the Trump world assumed that RFK took more from Biden than them because of the Kennedy name, and they changed their view. If you put on Sean Hannity, for a long time they were talking up RFK. They had him on their shows, and then he was starting to do well among Trump's voters, the anti-vax sort of crowd. And now Hannity constantly attacks RFK Jr. and talks about what a liberal he is and how he'd be the most liberal president ever. And so that's part of the slippage too. I think a lot of people really weren't at peace with the idea that this is going to be an election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, 82 and 77. And now that, I think post debate, I don't think RFK will get, I think CNN will successfully keep him off the stage in Atlanta later this month. And I do think people will sort of see this as a choice in a poll. If someone calls you to poll you and you don't really like either candidate and they give you the RFK option, you're going to say, oh, RFK. But I think it's really important and he deserves to be covered. I think he ends up potentially hurting Trump more. The sitting president's approval rating is below 40%. And that's he's way worse off than Jimmy Carter was in 1980 at this point. And, you know, whoever the challenger is to the incumbent, in theory, that should benefit the challenger. So if there's people splitting up the vote beyond just the challenger, that, you know, we'll see what happens.
Another topic where folks are saying, how can we not talking about this, is the selection of VP. Obviously, the Democratic Party, it's a done deal for Kamala Harris. How do you see Trump's choice playing out?
Donald Trump will do whatever it takes to win. He really does not want to face federal charges for January 6th or for the classified documents. And so he will do what Susie Wiles, his advisor, and Chris LaCivita and Jason Miller tell him will be most helpful. And I think that shifts. So the conventional wisdom is, like, the smart money in DC is on Tim Scott. I don't think it'll be Tim Scott. you could, the name, I don't know that she wants to do it. I don't think she's being vetted, but like a Sarah Huckabee Sanders would make a lot of sense. Governor of Arkansas, Tom Cotton is being vetted, Marco Rubio, Doug Burgum, but I'm not sure what do they bring? How do they help you win? I don't think Trump wants someone who is, you know, it's not going to be Elise Stefanik. But I think Trump loves the game of watching everyone go out and, you know, play surrogate for him. And, but ultimately the point is whoever Trump concludes in the summer is going to be most useful to help him win the election is who he's going to end up picking.
We've got just a moment left. And there are a bunch of questions here about AI. And I guess the question, simplest question is, what are you thinking in terms of protection against AI misdirection, misinformation, and how do you think the Post is going to handle this? It's a real threat. Question is, what do you do about it?
Yeah, I think we are constantly thinking about this. How do you prepare for this generative AI election? We have a visual forensics team that tries to detect deep fakes. Sometimes the challenge is you don't want to draw more attention to fake stuff circulating on the internet. So writing a story being like, this thing is fake, can perversely end up drawing way more attention to it. We're already seeing, you know, I think the fake robocall that went out on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, which was ham-handed, but it was someone with the Dean Phillips campaign was behind, and it was basically like a street magician who made this thing for $5 on the internet. And I don't think it actually suppressed the vote. And the consultant who commissioned it is being criminally charged in New Hampshire now. I think that there will be, yeah, there's always dirty tricks in politics. And now there are new tools that allow new forms of dirty tricks. The thing I worry about most, I think the thing institutionally we worry about the most, is the liar's dividend, which is the term for like, if we get into this place where you don't feel like you can trust anything you see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears, and you just don't, you can't believe anything, like that is bad for democracy. If you're sort of like, I don't, that's right out of like the Putin playbook. I don't believe anything. Everyone lies. And so Donald Trump responded to this ad that the Lincoln Project, this anti-Trump group, ran. And he said, all these videos in here are fake. This is all AI. Fox News shouldn't be running this on television because it's all AI. And it's like, no, these are all real clips. And there were fake photos circulating on social media last week of Trump being perp walked out of the courthouse in handcuffs. Those were fake. You know, it cuts both ways, but Trump's trying to benefit from this liar's dividend of like, oh, well, these clips making me look like an idiot are fake. And it sows the seeds of doubt. And so that's what I worry about. What I really worry about is an October surprise, something that happens. It's close election. It's going to come down to 100,000 votes. It's the weekend before the election. It's neck and neck. And all of a sudden there's a video of a candidate that appears to be in a compromising position or saying something. And we can't know definitively. We can't say for sure whether it's true or fake. And it's, everyone's talking about it on social media. You know, it's everyone's buzzing about it, and it's sort of like, well, is it true or not? And we don't know. And you have to say, here's what we do know, but then you're drawing more attention to it. So these are the kinds of things you have to think through and game out. And how are you going to deal with that? I think in 2016, the media made a mistake by overcovering the hacked emails that WikiLeaks put up. I think in 2020, the media made a mistake by undercovering the Hunter Biden laptop because there was a feeling that it might be Russian disinformation. In 2024, I fear we fight the last war. And so it's how do you cover things in a way that you don't get taken?
And we are out of time. But just quickly, the Washington Post is thinking through all these scenarios
every day. Yeah. And we have a head of AI. We have a visual forensics team. We have a lot of smart people who, you know, graph, like visual people. We, I think there's the operating assumption is when in doubt, don't run it. You know, we're not gonna take some thing unless we can verify it and write about it. It's just that if everyone else in the world is talking about it, it's not like the old days where, you know, the traditional legacy mainstream media, whatever you want to call the Post and the Times and the Journal, where they had this gatekeeping role. Now there's so many different voices out there that you can't just, if you're not sure if something's real or fake, you can't change your coverage of, you know, you have to, it is a brave new world.
James Holman, thank you so much. Yeah, this is a brave new world.
My pleasure. Great questions. Thank you.
I just want to quickly end with a shout out for programs that are coming up. We've got a bunch of programs coming up this summer and into the fall. Tuesday, August 13th, Colin Call, who was in the Defense Department as a policy guy, brilliant. He'll be here talking about national security challenges for the Trump or the Biden administration moving forward. He's a Stanford guy too. August 20th, we've got John Judis, who is a prominent left critic of the Democratic Party. We've got programs coming up with some of the prominent Republican leaders in the party as well. We'll be talking more about that. I want to let you know, if you're interested in this program, there'll be a video and a podcast up in a day or two. And if you registered, you will get a copy of that. Finally, please consider making a donation. These programs are free and open to the public, and that takes support. CSPG@umn.edu will get you to the spot that you need to be. Finally, James Holman, everyone here and online, thank you so much.
Thank you.